We have a higher morality. It's really a classic example of a liar who engaged in cheating because he's self-righteous by basically blaming Yaakov for not understanding that the older comes before. But Lamaisa, it's brought down that there's a fairly strong minhag in Klal Yisrael that, at least for girls, an older should get married before a younger. You will find among religious families that they will not even allow the younger to start dating until the older is engaged. And of course, if that's taking a real long time, they'll waive that requirement at some point. But certainly, they will strongly prefer that the older get married before the younger. And of course, their proof is Lavan, which is hardly a good proof. But once again, if the Torah supports this as a minhag, that implies that the bechira should be given before the tzeira. There's a third halachic principle that we derive from here as well, and that is, Laban tells him we can't marry off Rachel until the 7 days of rejoicing are finished. Well, why not? Why not have a wedding and then kind of have the days of rejoicing overlap? So from here we learn out a third halacha called Ein Ma'arvin Simcha V'Simcha. That means we don't intermingle one type of joy with another type. Now, specifically, where this falls off is that we don't make weddings during Chol HaMoed. Why not? Because since Chol HaMoed is a mitzvah to rejoice with the holiday, we don't want to detract from the simcha of the holiday with the simcha of the wedding. We might think the more the merrier, the more simcha you have, the better. But no, each simcha you should be fully focused on. So we don't intermingle one simcha with another simcha. And that is why, as it were, Laban did not want Rachel to marry Yaakov until after the Sheva Brachos, the week of Sheva Brachos of Leah. So this is halacha, Ein Ma'arvin Simcha V'Simcha. We don't mix simchas together. I mean, sometimes it's unavoidable. I mean, if you have a baby and the bris is on Yom Tov, so you know, you have to have the bris. But if it's a simcha that's delayable, you don't mix it with another simcha because every simcha should have its own place. So it's an interesting question. Who is considered to be the Baal Simcha? Meaning like this. In the case of Laman, the idea would be that Yaakov should not marry two women within the week of rejoicing of each other because that would take away the simcha. But imagine this situation. This is sometimes, you don't hear it that often, but it happens occasionally. Let's say a man has two daughters. Maybe they're the same age, maybe they're twin daughters, maybe they're not. And he wants to make a joint wedding. So the question would that be called one simcha detracting from another simcha? Or, I'll give you another example. You may have heard of Lahavdil Reverend Moon, the Moonies. And, they do these mass weddings where they marry maybe 10,000 couples. So what they do is what they do. But on my side, I believe after the Holocaust, when many, many Jews, you know, lost their families, etc., they would sometimes be Masader, and Ravana would be Masader, communal weddings, save money and the like, where many, many people would get married under the same chuppah, meaning you'd have like 10 people, 20 people, they would get married. Is that a violation of Ein Ma'arvin Simcha V'Simcha? So it's an interesting question. The Pashtus it would be. But some say no. Ein Ma'arvin Simcha V'Simcha would only be if you have one chassan marrying two kalas. He is the ikker one that has the chiyuv of Simcha. Right? Our chiyuv, when we're against the marriage, you understand, we don't have a chiyuv to be happy. Right? What is the chiyuv called? Mitzameach chassan v'kala. What does that mean? You have a mitzvah to make the chassan and the kala happy. So the people that have simcha are not even the parents of the bride and groom, although they're happy. It is the bride and the groom themselves. And I, as a guest, I don't have any obligation to be happy. I could hate being at a wedding, as far as it's concerned. But my obligation is to make or assist the chasen and the kala. That's why it's misameach chasen v'kala. So some say, therefore, that in spite of the fact that the parents are usually paying for the wedding, but the balei simcha, people who actually have the mitzvah of simcha or the chasen and the kala, so as long as you have separate chasen and kalas, I'm getting married to her and you're getting married to her, so our simchas do not overlap, that would not be a chisoren of Ein Ma'arvin Simcha V'Simcha. Right? That's what some opinions say. So the kisser from this Laban, who was such a great cheater, he actually won out three halakhic ideas. One is the 7 days of rejoicing for Chasna Nakala. That's called Shiva Shemir Mishnah. Now, we don't learn out that you recite seven brachas. That's a separate thing. We learn out that the rejoicing period is 7 days. The second thing we learn out is that the minhag is a proper minhag to try to get your older daughter married before your younger. It's my book, is why I apply that to boys too, or only to the girls. And the third halacha is the rule of Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. So when polygamy was permitted, like for Sephardim, one chassan is not having two wives at the same time or within a week. But whether that applies to different chassans, different kalas who are getting married back in baby space, that already is a big, that's a big machloket, how to apply that rule. But it is fascinating that love on himself is a source of this halacha. And again, remember that Rachel and Leah were only separated by a week. Not wait 7 years. And his children were actually born during this period of time, so they could get both of those wives. Now, another thing to keep in mind, that people do raise the question that if Yaakov had relations with a woman, and he thought that woman was Rachel, and that woman turns to be Leah because it's totally dark. So why is he stuck with the wife at all? I mean, L'chaira, this is a classic instance of what is called a kedushin under mistake. Right? If you think you're marrying, of course, we have the same thing. In a sense, you understand that all of this is a mita keneged mita. I think we spoke last week that although Yaakov Avinu was justified in taking the brother, but since Yaakov did it by deception, the Midas HaDin demands that Yaakov becomes victimized by deception. That which you gain by sheker. So in Mela, if Yaakov Avinu says, I'm not married to Leah because I intended to marry Rachel and I didn't intend to marry Leah, so we could say back to Yaakov, you don't have the brachas from your father Yitzchak because he intended to bless Esau, and instead he blessed you. If you maintain that, hey, who cares who we intended? I got the bracha, therefore it belongs to me. Well, by that admission itself, you, Yaakov, are going to be married to it later.
But I would question that. It's not, I don't decide if I have the bracha. Hashem decides if I have the bracha. Well, with the marriage, you can kind of say, I didn't know, therefore, it doesn't work. That's a little bit more in my control compared to brachas, which are Hashem's.
The brachas are ultimately what Hashem decides, and kedushin is what a person decides. So you're saying there's still a question that why would Yaakov be married if it's there is a very good point to what you're saying. Lemaisa and the Mefarshim say that theoretically, halachically, had Yaakov wanted to simply annul his marriage to Leah, he could have done so. But Yaakov realized, similar to what Yitzchak realized, that this must have been the will of God. And indeed, it's no accident that six of the tribes, including Levi, from which comes the Kohanim and Levim, and including Yehuda, from which comes the Malkei Beis David and Moshiach, are from this wife that is almost the accidental wife, and the wife that is even described as the hated one. The word hated is a very, very strong term. Very, very strong term. And if you took it literally, you would really be confronted with this situation. Yaakov had a wife that he hated. That's what the Pasuk says. But the Mefarshim, all the Mefarshim learned that hate is not meant to be understood in the way we would understand it. First of all, a tzaddik would not hate a righteous person. There's no way a tzaddik would hate. But hated is a comparative term, meaning to say, compared to what he felt for Rachel, it was as if Leah was hated, but certainly, you know, he loved Rachel as well. And of course, who can forget that who is buried next to Yaakov Avinu in Ma'aras HaMachpelah? It is Leah that is buried next to Yaakov Avinu. Rachel is buried in Kever Rachel. So there's a lot of paradoxes here. Leah is the wife, as it were, who is accidental. Leah is the wife that Yaakov was tricked into marrying. Leah is the wife that is described as Sanua, albeit in a relative sense. and yet Leia has the majority of Am Yisrael, as well as Kahuna and Malchus, and Leia has the privilege of the eternal rest next to Yaakov. The Midrash comments the following idea, amazing idea. It says in Koheles, Ecclesiastes, Elohim Yivakesh Es HaNirdak. God defends the victim. God defends the persecuted, oppressed one. The very fact that Leah suffered a measure of emotional pain, Hashem compensates the blessings of children, the blessings of being connected to Yaakov on a level that Rachel is not. God stands up for the underdog. Elohim Yivakesh Es HaNirdak. Now, Rachel, you'll recall, getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Yaakov is gone, say 14 years of shame, Abraham, 22 years altogether. In love and power, back. When he comes back to Eretz Israel, really next week's parsha, Rachel dies almost right away. So let me digress a little bit to explain why does Rachel die right away. And Rachel is buried in Beis Lechem, which is, of course, the site of Rachel. There's a beautiful medrash that says that this was the route that the Jews would take hundreds and hundreds of years later on their way to the Babylonian exile. And Rachel is the one that cries for them. And Rachel begs Hashem for mercy. And she was there too for the Bnei Yisrael to think of her and be connected to her as they're going to Golos. But here is a very fascinating thought that Ramban mentions. And this is part of a much larger question, which many would say said many, many answers. I'm only going to talk about a little piece of it now. Chazal had this story that even though the Torah was not given yet, and the Jews were not, the others were not commanded to keep the mitzvot, but they knew with Ruach HaKodesh what the Torah would say, and they kept the Torah even before it was given. Right? You heard this in the tradition. This is the Gemara in Kedushin and the like. So as a result, there's a whole genre of mafarshim that points out different things that the Avos did that didn't seem to correspond with the Torah. And we could simply say the Torah wasn't given yet. That would be fine, but Chazal say they kept it anyway. And one of the many questions, and this is many, I'm just going to talk about one question, is that the Torah permits polygamy. The Torah permits a man to have more than one wife. That's fine. That among Ashkenazim, polygamy only became prohibited in the time of Rabbeinu Gershom, which was in the 1000s, right, shortly before Rashi. That's fine. But even though the Torah permits polygamy, the one thing the Torah does not permit is marrying two sisters. You cannot marry two sisters. You cannot marry two sisters. That is an error. That even for Yibam you don't do. Let's say, for example, two brothers marry two sisters, which is allowed. Not their own sisters, two brothers marry two sisters. One of the brothers dies without kids. The survivor, I'm not allowed to do Yibam on that woman because that woman is the sister of my wife. She doesn't even have Yibam. So here's the question. Rachel and Leah are sisters. So how could Yaakov marry two sisters? So if you say, again, that it's before Matan Torah, so it's very good. But if you say the Avos kept the Torah before Matan Torah, how could Yaakov marry two sisters? Famous, famous question. Again, there are many questions like this, but this is one of the questions. So, one answer the Maharal gives is that Rachel and Leah are renouncing the paganism of Laban. They essentially did the equivalent of a conversion. They converted, but it's not clear what conversion to Judaism meant. There wasn't Judaism per se, but they converted to the belief in one God, and therefore they had the status of Gerer. Now, you know, there's a principle in the laws of conversion that when a person converts to Judaism, he is like a newborn entity. It's like all of the past relationships, emotionally they can still exist, but halakhically they don't exist anymore. Do you know that that means, as I think we mentioned it, that do reisa, if a father and daughter convert, they can marry, do reisa. If a brother and sister convert, they can marry. If a mother and son convert, they can marry, because they're not related. Now, Midrabanan, that's forbidden because of appearances and everything else, so please do not go out and quote me that says, oh, Gerer can marry his sister who converts with him. But Maharal says like this, if we understand that Rachel and Leah underwent a conversion, they would no longer be deemed sisters. That's why Yaakov could marry them. right? So that would be one answer to my relatives. But Ramban gives another answer. Ramban gives an interesting answer. Ramban says that before Matan Torah, the Avos didn't have to keep the Torah. It was before Matan Torah. But they wanted to. They wanted to. They, number one, through Ruach HaKodesh and prophecy, they knew what the Torah would say. And number two, they wanted to serve Hashem in this way. So the Ramban says, this notion of what you might call the optional observance of the Torah, it's optional because it was before Matan Torah, only applied when they were in Eretz Yisrael. Because of the holiness of Eretz Yisrael, because they were in the palace of the king, they wanted to keep the Torah even if they didn't have it. But when the Avos were in Chutz La'aretz, then they didn't feel any particular need to keep the Torah. Now, once the Torah is given, we don't differentiate, except for Truma and things like that. Once the Torah is given, we don't differentiate between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. But in the pre-Matan Torah state, the Ramban says, when it was simply a matter of their feeling and how to serve Hashem, they felt more of an obligation in the land of Israel than they felt outside. So therefore the Ramban says very beautifully, since Yaakov married Rachel and Leah when he was in Lavan's house, that was in Haran, northern Syria, it was Chutz La'aretz, Yaakov had no problem in marrying two sisters. This is the Ramban. Now, the Ramban says, this is why. As soon as they come back to Eretz Yisrael, right? Yaakov, as soon as he steps over the border, Yaakov is now under that stricter standard that says you're not supposed to marry two sisters. So which one dies? The second one that he married. So now that's why Rachel dies, because Rachel is the sister of his wife. Which means the following. This is very amazing. What did Rachel give up? Right. We know the story of the very famous Medrash. It's not in the Chumash directly, but we know the famous Medrash that Rachel and Yaakov suspected that Lavan would try to switch women on him. Right. Now again, today in our world of electric light and like all of this is totally inconceivable that you're not going to know who you're with. But again, in the time of total darkness, you know that could have been possible. So as you just said, Rachel and Yaakov made up some hand signals that would communicate. And at the last minute, Rachel, not wanting her sister to be humiliated in the wedding night, actually gave Leah those simanim so they would spend the night, Yaakov and Leah would spend the night in peace and harmony without Yaakov discovering the deception. Now, when we look at the greatness of Rachel, so we think, it's a wonderful thing. She gave up that wedding night. Of course, she only waited a week. She didn't wait 7 years. She only waited a week, but she made herself get married a week later. Okay? So you might think on some superficial level, well, no. If it's only a week, what's the great deal? But you actually see that Rachel giving Leah the simanim was giving Rachel a death sentence when they come back to Eretz Yisrael. Because I'm not sure if Rachel was aware of this, but if the dynamic is, once they enter Eretz Yisrael, Yaakov cannot be married to two sisters, and therefore the second one to be married dies. Rachel, putting herself as the second wife, is condemning herself to death. So actually, this in a very literal sense, is Rachel putting her life on the line in order to spare Leah embarrassment. Now, there is a question you could ask, and I actually don't have such a good terrorist, maybe something you can think about. You wrote Kiddush. Now, there's a famous statement of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter that it's not proper to be a tzaddik on somebody else's cheshbon. Meaning, you want to be a tzaddik, you want to be firm, you want to be righteous. Don't be righteous when it inconveniences somebody else. So, for example, just to give you an example of the actual story, Marin Kuhn says when you wash your hands for a suda, although all you need is a revius of water. Revius is just 4 ounces, but the more water you pour, the more bracha you get. Right? You get a lot of bracha for being a lot of water in a tefillah time. So, Rav Yisrael Salanter was once a guest in somebody's home, and he was pouring the tiniest, most minimum amount of water over his fingers, not even covering the whole hand, because of the eved, the tefillah time is kosher to the knuckle. somebody said, well, why are you so consumptive? We have water. Why don't you pour the water? So he said, this is before indoor plumbing, that there was a maidservant who had to get water from the well. So he says, I want to be a tzaddik. I want to do a mitzvah. What gives me the right to do a mitzvah if that's going to cause... Not what I have to do is what I have to do, but what gives me the right to go beyond the halacha if that's going to cause someone inconvenience? So another story they tell is that Rousseau Solander used to travel around a lot. He would go to different cities to teach and be a mushuk. So one of his disciples invited him for Shabbos. And he said, oh, it would be such an honor to have the Rebbe for Shabbos. I want you to do it. He's a wealthy man. He's a wealthy business guy. He said, you should know, our sudas of Baruch Hashem are so wonderful. You know, we have, of course, we have wonderful food, but I know that's not what the Rebbe cares about. But we have, between every course, we have Divrei Torah, and we have Sumiros, and we have singing, and we have Torah. And, you know, between the courses is an hour of Divrei Torah, so the meal goes, you know, 6-7 hours of Luchni is tremendous. So Rousseau Solander said to him, I will go to your house on the condition that we have no breaks at all, we just eat the courses straight, and that we finish within an hour. So, you know, just eat, you know, eat and run. You know, watch my kiddush, eat, betch. That's what I want. No Divrei Torah, no Zemiros. So the person was very, very shocked. And he said, well, that's what the Rebbe wants. You know, eight, you know, 1, 2, 3. So afterwards, the person was very confused. He didn't understand, like, what type of Shabbos meal was this. It was nothing at all. So Rabbi Saul Slander then says, I'd like to speak to the maid. This was a wealthy person, the maid who does the cooking in the kitchen. So they call out the maid. And Rousseau Solander says, I want to apologize for rushing you. I know that this is much faster than usual. I hope it wasn't too difficult for you to be rushed. Rebbe, this was the greatest day of my life. Now, every Friday, I come here. And I'm here like till 2 o'clock in the morning. And then I come home to my own son, who's 11 years old. And we have a little suda for a half an hour. Anyway, and I'm dead tired. And he's dead tired. And I never, she was a widow. I never spend any time with my son. This was the first time in whatever it is, 5 years, that I was able to have a Suda Shabbos for franchises. You know, Hashem should bless you. So Solander looked at his Talmud and said, you want to be a tzaddik with your Zemiros, with your Divrei Torah, at the expense of keeping this woman away from her child. You don't be a tzaddik on somebody else's kashrut. It's a very famous teaching of very small Solander. So the question I have, is, what do we say here? Rachel, you know, knows that Yaakov is being cheated. But so Rachel, you know, doesn't want Leah to be embarrassed. Rachel is willing to give up her wedding opportunity. Rachel is willing to even perhaps die early because she will be the wife's sister. But the ultimate question is, Rachel's self-sacrifice is at the expense of deceiving and tricking Yaakov. So isn't this a classic instance of how can your righteousness be at the expense of deceiving? But it could be, just thinking out loud, it could very well be that on some deep level, Yaakov might have preferred this. Meaning like this. If Rachel would be discovered, I'm sorry, if Leah would be discovered, Leah would be deeply humiliated. So in a sense, let's imagine that Rachel would pose this question to Yaakov in the abstract, hypothetical question. There is somebody who will get tremendously embarrassed when the other person discovers the deception. I have a way of preventing that. Is it better to prevent humiliation at the expense of deceiving somebody? Or is it better that somebody shouldn't be deceived and discover it if it'll cause humiliation? Imagine that Shiloh, because here, no matter what happens, something bad is going to happen. Meaning, if Rachel doesn't give Leah the simanim, Leah is going to be exposed in the middle of the night, and there's going to be deep humiliation. But Yaakov is not going to be deceived, because he won't consummate the marriage once he discovers who she is. So, which is the greater evil? Is the greater evil tricking somebody? Or is the greater evil humiliating somebody? Rachel has a chance to determine which of those two things are happening. Now, if she would have asked Yaakov himself, is it better to prevent humiliation or is it better to prevent deception? Yaakov himself might well have said, humiliation is like murder. Embarrassing somebody is murder. So it is better to prevent somebody's murder, even at the risk of deception. So it could very well be that this is not an example of being besotted in somebody else's cheshbon, precisely because Yaakov himself would have preferred to be deceived this way instead of a scenario that someone would have suffered that embarrassment. That might be a possible answer. Yeah.
I'm sure this is a cliche question, but yeah. Going back to the concept that the Avos know the Torah
right.
beforehand with the Ruach HaKodesh, so how does that work with the fact that he didn't know that Leah was under the...
No. It's a good question, but the answer to that is you have to understand, when we say the Avos knew the Torah, they didn't know the biographical parts of the Torah, they knew the commandments. Yaakov didn't know that he was being deceived at the time. You know? He didn't know the story. He didn't know his life. But he knew the commandments of the Torah. Yeah.
With the keeping, like I've heard this explanation before, with the keeping Torah in Israel, but Kutzar Israel Meir's when they came back in, Yaakov died. But it was, I had a question on this as well, is that it wasn't mandatory that they keep in Eretz Yisrael.
Yep.
It was optional. He brought it on
yep.
himself. So
right.
it's not like it's Hashem who killed her. He didn't kill her when they came back in. It's Hashem, and Hashem didn't command him.
That is an excellent question. That's a good kasha on the Ramban, because even in Eretz Yisrael, the Torah, exactly as you said, was not mandatory. It was optional. So if it was optional, then why should Rachel suffer the consequences on something that didn't have to be kept? It's a very good point. But apparently, this is an unusual type of option, optional type of observance, meaning to say, the Avos made a voluntary choice to make themselves obligated. So once they made that choice, they choose to be obligated. Therefore, Hashem treats them as if they are obligated.
If someone were to marry two sisters, what happens?
Okay.
Is he not in fact married? Does it work for the other?
No. It does not work for the other. Essentially, this is what is called erva, a forbidden
yeah.
sexual relationship, and therefore the kiddushin of number two is not valid. She does not even need a get. The marriage is... See, it's a complicated... This is a very complicated shaila generally. There are certain types of forbidden marriages which after the fact are valid marriages, although prohibited. For example, if a kohen were to marry a divorced woman, that is prohibited, but it is a valid marriage and he must give her a get, meaning it's not null and void, it's a marriage that must be terminated.
Doraisa is prohibited.
Doraisa is prohibited. But even if it's prohibited Doraisa, it'll be a valid prohibited marriage. By valid, I don't mean permissible, but valid, I mean it needs a get. But if a person, for example, were to try to Makadesh his sister, or his daughter, or his mother, or the sister of his wife, that's one of the list. That's not just a prohibited marriage, that is a void marriage, meaning to say it's nothing at all. It's like marrying a goy. If a Jew tries to marry a non-Jew, if it's not a marriage, that is not a, you know, you don't need anything for that. So this is what is called erva. So when something is called erva, the kiddushin is not valid at all.
So why would she have to die then? Seemingly they would just enter the unknown of Israel and she wouldn't be married to him.
Yes. that's an interesting question. But I think my answer to that would be that I'm combining it. Since the mitzvah was in fact not mandatory, it was optional, so although Yaakov could assume the responsibilities of the commandment, including the punishment, he could not take the leniency that it's not a valid marriage. He has a leniency. To say the marriage is not valid, you don't need to get or anything, that would be a kula, that would not be a chumra. So Yaakov cannot use his optional observance of the Torah to create loopholes and leniencies, and therefore, that's a very excellent topic. Yeah.
So going back on those points about voluntary obligations and all this and all that,
yeah.
it's all very like the kahila, but even here and there, it's all over the place. So it's obviously very uneasing for us, especially when we're talking about the abbas. How do we resolve such a thing?
Yes, so the truth of the matter is, the easiest answer, ultimately, and this is part of a huge puzzle, because I just gave you one example. There's so many examples that, of course, you go on. The Maharal says, the simplest of all, the Maharal says that this was not an absolute rule. The abbas tried to keep the Torah, but when there were very important spiritual reasons. Because in fact, that's how he lived. Yaakov married Rachel and Leah because these were the most righteous women from whom Am Yisrael has to come. In other words, the Maharal doesn't feel we have to shoehorn every decision the Abbas made and make it consistent with the mitzvahs. He says, when there was an important, powerful reason, they were not bound by the Torah. This is before Matan Torah. Okay, we'll stop here.